Welcome, I'm Hanat Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Outbreaks of illness from contaminated foods are on the rise, and as our food supply becomes increasingly globalized, more and more, the origins of foodborne pathogens are from outside the U.S. Ponder these numbers. 15% of our nation's total food supply is imported from elsewhere. 80% of seafood, half of fresh fruits, 20% of vegetables. According to the FDA Commissioner, Dr. Margaret Hamburg, in a New York Times interview, one in every six Americans becomes ill from eating contaminated food each year. About 130,000 are hospitalized and 3,000 die. The FDA currently only inspects 1 to 2% of all imports at American ports and borders. To deal with this growing concern, the Obama administration introduced the Food Safety Modernization Act back in 2011, but many say it hasn't been enough. So Obama recently proposed new regulations that are meant to tighten up food safety on imported foods even further. These proposals are now in a public comment period. So today, we're taking the opportunity to talk about imported food, what we need to know about how it's grown, how it's inspected, how it's shipped and labeled. And joining us is Michelle Simon. She's a public health lawyer and policy consultant for the Center for Food Safety and also the author of Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back. She joins us by phone from Oakland. Welcome to Your Call, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, thanks for being here. And also, Marion Nessel is a professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University. She writes a monthly Food Matters column for the San Francisco Chronicle, and she blogs at Food Politics. She's also the author of Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics, and the forthcoming Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics. She joins us by phone. Hi, Marion.
Glad to be here.
Well, thank you both for being on. So let's start off by talking about some of these recent food recalls and outbreaks of illness caused by tainted, contaminated foods. Recently on Al Jazeera, the FDA said it announced that salad mix shipped by Taylor Farms in Mexico contain the Cyclospora parasite, and that's responsible for a severe stomach virus. Then on Sunday, New Zealand-based Fonterra announced it had supplied whey protein to food suppliers that may contain bacteria. And then the New York Times said that in recent months, pomegranate seeds from Turkey used in a berry mix sickened more than 150 people across the country with hepatitis A. Cucumbers imported from Mexico were linked to an outbreak of salmonella that made 84 people ill in 18 states. So lots to talk about. You know, my first question is why and how can this still happen in, 2013 in the, one of the most industrialized nations in the world, the United States? Michelle, how does this even happen and at this on this level?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's happening because we have an increasingly globalized food supply. So it's really no wonder when you realize that so many of our foods are being imported and ingredients for foods, for restaurants, for processed foods here are being imported from all over the globe. And it's just an impossible task for our federal regulators, for anyone really, to get a handle on proper inspection. So that's why, as you mentioned, there are new laws to try to increase inspection and try to really tighten some controls. But it's not a surprise when you really think about how globalized our food system is today.
But why? What is difficult? Why is it so impossible? You mentioned, it's just really impossible. Is it that big, of an industry? Is it this behemoth of an industry that can't be controlled?
Well, look, microscopic bugs are hard to get a handle on no matter what. But I think what's happening is not only is our food supply globalized, but the food system is industrialized, meaning that no longer are they just, small farmers growing small plots of land. These are massive farms. And then what happens is if you have a a contamination, say, in one type of lettuce that gets mixed into, you know, these days there are all kinds of lettuce mixes, and then they get shipped all over the country or the world, you can imagine how just a small contamination that may have been localized, it was, if it was contained to a small farm, you know, nearby, but once you start mixing it with other products, once you start shipping it all over the world, then that's really what magnifies these sorts of outbreaks.
And what kind of regulations are in place for,
well,
this?
Yeah. Well, I want to correct something you said. So the Food Safety Modernization Act is what gave FDA increased authority to then carry out the regulations that have followed. So legally, that's just a process that goes when we have a law passed. We then have regulations that the Food and Drug Administration carries out to implement the law that Congress passed a couple years ago. We needed that law because prior to that, FDA had virtually no authority, even though it regulates most of the food supply. And so, you know, the good news is that this new law has been put in place, again, to increase controls. Prior, FDA could only do border inspections, which is just crazy. They could only inspect something like 2% of our imports at the border. That's just not a feasible way to do things. So the new law says that the burden is now on the importer, on the company that is importing foods into the U.S., to ensure that U.S.-based safety controls are being implemented by these globalized food producers. Now, it remains to be seen how that's all going to play out and whether, you know, there's going to be enough funding. I mean, it's all kinds of open questions. But the point is, at least we are looking for these regulations to be implemented in a way that will put additional controls and inspections, paperwork, to ensure that U.S.-based food safety rules are being followed by these globalized food producers.
Marion Nessel, if you can take us back a little bit in history and kind of explain why we haven't had, you know, tighter regulations and why it took, you know, it's all the way until 2011 for us to have them. What was in place before, and why wasn't this a big deal before?
Oh, it's been a big deal for a very long time. It's just politically impossible to deal with. To understand where we are now, you have to go back to 1906, more than 100 years ago, when the Congress first passed food safety laws. And Congress, in its infinite wisdom, chose to pass two different sets of food safety laws, both of them at the time in the Department of Agriculture. One was in one department, one was in another department. One covered certain kinds of foods, one covered another. But as the department changed and the FDA got split off from the Department of Agriculture, we ended up with a food safety system that was basically bifurcated between two agencies, the Department of Agriculture and the FDA. The Department of Agriculture in charge of meat and poultry safety, and the FDA in charge of basically everything else, as if animal waste wasn't the big problem of contamination of fruits and vegetables. So the system itself was divided in a way that doesn't reflect today's globalized food supply in any way whatsoever. The other part of it is that the food industry hates regulation. And they would rather self-regulate and do it themselves. And they have a lot of friends in Congress. And so whenever the FDA would attempt to get even the same kinds of rules that the Department of Agriculture was able to get, Congress would say no. And, you know, one of the things that I'm constantly harping on is that the FDA gets its funding through agricultural appropriations committees, not through health appropriations committees, even though the FDA is part of the Department of Health and Human Services and part of the Public Health Service. So what that means is that agriculture appropriations committees are in charge of deciding how much funding a public health agency is going to get. And this is we now have a Congress that can't pass a farm bill. And they're certainly not going to be generous to the FDA. In fact, what Congress has done over the last 25 years is to assign the FDA more and more tasks to do, more and more requirements that the FDA is absolutely must do, but has not appropriated additional funding to do it. So the FDA is essentially trying to carry out this enormous, impossible task with very limited resources, limited personnel, limited funding.
And with the food industry pushing back.
And the food industry pushing back anytime they want to regulate. So the FDA kind of explains that it gets foods from 150 different countries. This isn't even counting, you know, hundreds and thousands of shipments coming in every day. And it has the capacity to inspect about 2% of imported foods, and that's a paper inspection. That means they're just looking at the paperwork. They're not even going in and pulling some of those containers apart to see what's actually in there. So the mystery to me is not why there are so many outbreaks. The mystery to me is why there aren't more.
Michelle Simon, the basic question, why do we import so much food? You know, my daughter asked me this the other day. We picked up some package of something at Trader Joe's, and it said made in Canada. And she said, but Mommy, you know, America's so big, and there's all these farms, and why do we need to bring food from somewhere else?
Yeah.
So what? But, why?
Right. Well, children often are pretty wise. It is a good question. And, you know, look, it's a matter of economics. I mean, it is pretty crazy when you realize that we're importing apples from New Zealand when, you know, we have perfectly good apples in Washington State, even here in California, and certainly on the East Coast. But, you know, with global trade being such a huge part of our economy, I mean, the federal government really pushes for that. So we have all kinds of trade agreements and, you know, look, a restaurant chain is going to import, like in this case of this Cyclospora outbreak, you know, the chain Darden, which owns Red Lobster and Olive Garden, which is implicated in the outbreak, they were getting their lettuce from Mexico probably because it was cheaper to do that than to get it, you know, somewhere in the United States. I mean, obviously, a big chain like that, they count every penny. So, unfortunately, you know, when economics drives the system and not public health, this is the kind of outcome we get.
I want to get the callers in on this early. I know many of you probably have experiences to share. So if you've had experiences with food contamination, if you have questions about imported foods, how to regulate imported foods, what's been your experience? Do you look on the label when you buy lettuce or a packaged food? Do you care if it's from somewhere else? Do you now care after all, you know, these news articles about contamination? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255 if you'd like to make a comment or ask our experts here a question. You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org, and we'll get your email on the air. So the Food Modernization Act of 2011, so 2011, we finally got an act, and that was in a way a response to food illness outbreaks. So, Marion, did it not go far enough, or why are we having tighter regulations now? What's changing?
You mean, why did it take 2 years to get the regulations out? We had an election in between, is a quick and dirty answer to that, and nothing happens during an election year that's likely to cause any controversy. The new piece of the FDA has come out now with three of what I think are four or five sets of regulations to implement the law, and all of them will require food producers to follow standard food safety practices. What a concept. What everybody really needs to understand is that we know perfectly well how to produce food safely. Those rules have been in place forever. They were developed for NASA when NASA was worried about sending astronauts into outer space and worried about getting them food poisoning under conditions of zero gravity. All you can say is, ugh, what a horrible thought. They wanted to make sure that no astronaut ever got sick in outer space, and so they contracted with Pillsbury, the baking company, which had instituted food safety plans that were working, to develop a food safety plan that would work in outer space. And, you know, my feeling is if it works in outer space, it ought to work on Earth. And so these are called HACCP rules, and now they're called something else. They have some other name for it, equally obscure. But what it involves is identifying places in the production chain where problems can occur, taking steps to fix those problems, and then monitoring to make sure that the steps were taken. I mean, really straightforward. And to the extent that the plans are well designed and thoughtfully designed and really do get at where the hazards occur, it absolutely works if they're followed. But companies don't want to because it has a cost associated with it, and it apparently is easier for companies to pay the fines and medical expenses and everything else and the legal fees because there are huge lawsuits that take place around these food safety problems. For them, it's cheaper to pay all that than it is to do what they need to do in the first place.
It's a bottom line issue.
Which is to follow food safety regulations and just do it, and do it thoughtfully and sensibly, and get everybody on board at the production facility to understand that this is really important and you don't want to be killing your consumers.
Right. And I also want to ask about, you know, how differently is imported food treated than our own domestic food? Is the process different? Is it very different, Michelle?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked that. But just to further on the delay, I just want to note that it actually took a lawsuit from the Center for Food Safety to force FDA and the White House to get these regulations out the door. So if not for that lawsuit, we would not even have the regulations out yet. That was forced by litigation, just another you know, way that we have to force the government to do the right thing. But you're raising a really good point about, look, you know, we have outbreaks here in the U.S., from U.S.-based food all the time. And it's the same problem. It's about the industrialization of food. So a good example of this being the horrible outbreak in Cantaloupe a couple of years ago, 33 people died. I mean, it still boggles my mind. Eating a melon and, you know, a simple act of eating a fresh, healthy food. And this was a farm in Colorado that just did not use good practices that, as Marion says, we've known for years what it takes, but they, you know, weren't following those practices, and over 30 people died. I mean, it just boggles my mind, you know. And so there are other rules that are part of this new FDA set of regulations that are attempting to deal with high-risk produce items like melon, like lettuce, et cetera.
Right. And it kind of makes sense to scrutinize the imported food more than the domestic food. Would that make sense? Are we talking about that?
It's harder to get a handle on what's going on with imported food, obviously, because we can't be there. But we can't inspect all the food that's grown in the U.S. either. I mean, really, the problems are similar, right? And again, in terms of how the food is produced on these large industrial farms and then how it's shipped all over the place. I mean, in the melon outbreak, it was 28 states. So, you know, the cyclospora outbreak is 18 states. You know, it just happened to have come from Mexico. So I think the bigger issue here is really industrialized food practices and the bottom line, you know, trumping public health, whether the food is grown here or overseas.
Mm. All right, let's get some callers on the line. Marion, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, can I weigh in here on something just quickly? The idea that melon is a high-risk food is just shocking. You peel it before you eat it. And the melon situation was something where I think there was a problem in the packing plant where the outside of the melon got contaminated. But again, this is because it's processing a billion melons. The other thing is that industrial food isn't necessarily unsafe. There are industrial food producers who follow food safety programs to the letter and are really careful about it. And if you ask them what they're doing in Mexico that's different from what they're doing in the United States, they will tell you that they do in Mexico exactly what they're doing in the United States. They've got clean water. They've got a sanitation plan in place. They are just as careful. But it's not everybody.
Mm. All right. Let's,
so it's
let's,
the corner cutting. That's the problem.
Right. Let's take a caller. And again, our number, if you'd like to chime in, if you have a comment or question or an experience with food contamination or a question to one of our experts, give us a call. 866-798-TALK. 866-798-8255. Or email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go to Keith in Mountain View. Keith, welcome to Your Call.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So I just wanted to make a comment about, so not only these issues you guys are talking about, but what role does the homogeny of, like, crops and animal populations have to do with, like, the amount at which these animals are getting infected, not just them being overstimulated with antibacterials and over pesticided, but like that the actual genetic diversity of these crops is getting narrower and therefore they get infected more regularly.
Okay, thanks, Keith. Michelle, you want to take that one?
Yeah, I'm not sure if monocropping per se has a lot to do with these problems, but I don't know. What do you think, Marion?
I think anytime you have big, you've got problems, and big doesn't make it simpler. It makes it more complicated in lots of ways. And it, I think all of these issues are tied together. If you didn't have monocropping, you wouldn't have big industrial agriculture. So in that sense, they're related.
Okay.
And one more factor I would say, and that we lose sight of sometimes, and depends on the type of bug. But for example, with E. coli, you know, odds are it's coming from runoff from a factory farm, and if that's contaminating lettuce, I mean, you know, lettuce doesn't get E. coli contaminated unless it comes from somewhere. So, you know, often that's where the factory farm issue comes in, where you have on a, from a neighboring farm that's contaminating, you know, what would have otherwise been a healthy product.
Let's go to another caller, Wanda in Berkeley. Hi, Wanda. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm calling because I recently was reading about that the FDA, the USDA, and the USAID are all Obama has appointed all ex-Monsanto and DuPont biotech industry executives to be running these agencies. And I'm actually much more concerned about our food being, you know, genetically modified, biosynthesized, and that kind of thing. Then, you know, I feel that I can protect myself from these bugs. You know, we've had those for all the time, and I think people do need to be protected, but I don't think these are the people that we're, I mean, it's all of a sudden we're trusting those people to do it. I just think that's kind of naive, or you know, they are really people who are, why are fruits and vegetables coming from China that are, you know, 59 cents a pound, or, you know, this was something a while ago that I noticed in stores, and people would say, oh, you can get it cheaper at, you know, the Berkeley Bowl, or, and, you know, the reason is because somebody is trying to undermine our farmers. Mm-hmm. You know, there's ulterior reasons for a lot of these laws that are being passed. And the people who are, there are corporate interests. And I think we can, it's not as simple as just that you pass this law and all of a sudden we've got government, you know, we do have government, but government is not necessarily working for the people.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Wanda. Thanks, Wanda. So, Marion, this whole idea of who makes up the FDA, who really makes up these organizations that are, you know, overlooking everything. We have about a minute before break, so if we can start talking about it now. Who are they? Who are these people?
Well, we can put it very simply that there's a lot of corporate interest in what goes on at the FDA, and there's a revolving door so that people go in and out of industry in the FDA. They work for the FDA for a while, and the industry hires them to deal with the FDA once they're working for the company, and vice versa. And that's how politics runs. In our country, the FDA argues that they can't get enough independent people to make these kinds of decisions. I don't know whether that's true or not. I don't think they're trying very hard. And also, independent is in the eye of the perceiver. I'm considered to be an enormously biased.
All right. That's Marion Nessel. Also with us is Michelle Simon. This is Your Call. We'll be right back.
This is Your Call on KALW. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question you feel needs to be answered, please get in touch with us by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Hanat Baba sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, what's behind the latest round of efforts at peace talks for Palestine and Israel? The talks are set to resume today. What can be accomplished and how is the U.S. exerting its foreign policy in the Middle East? On Friday, it's our weekly media roundtable where we talk to journalists about coverage of the week's news. And today, how can we make imported food safer? We're talking about how we regulate imported food, which now accounts for about 15% of what we eat in the U.S. Due to a recent spike in illness from contaminated food. The Obama administration is proposing tightening up regulations through the Food Safety Modernization Act. And we also want to hear from you what has been your experiences with food contamination. When you buy food, when you go to the store and get your food, do you look on the package? Do you care where it's from? Are you one of those who only buys local? And if you don't mind the imported food, has that changed because of all these salmonella outbreaks and illnesses that have been caused by imported contaminated food? Joining us is Michelle Simon, a public health lawyer, author of Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back, and also Marion Nessel, professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at NYU, author of Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics, and Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics. And we are taking your calls at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And before the break, we were talking about who runs the FDA. And we did actually, we would like to say that we did invite the FDA on today's show, but they declined to be on the program. So let me actually, we have full lines, but if you'd still like to give us a call, 866-798-TALK. Let's go to another caller. Let's go to Barbara in San Francisco. Hi, Barbara. Welcome to Your Call.
Yeah, thank you very much. I just have kind of a general question. I spend a lot of time in Cape May County, New Jersey, and you know, New Jersey is going to be the first built-out state in the union with regard to losing its farmland at the quickest clip in the country. And I'm just wondering, you know, for example, we used to have the best tomatoes pretty much in the country, and now everything's shipped from Mexico, and the peach farmers, the tomato farmers, the lima bean farmers, everyone has been, you know, gradually eradicated for sprawl, mall, build-out. And I'm just kind of wondering if your speakers could comment on, you know, what do they see by way of the future in terms of laws that would rather more encourage the whole concept of obviously grow local, buy local, and to kind of combat the general perception of, you know, buying agro, you know, large, you know, companies, you know, the agribusiness, et cetera, and bulk and quantity versus quality.
Thank you, Barbara. Michelle, you want to take that one? How to protect kind of locally grown produce and that movement? Is it being encouraged enough?
Mm-hmm. Well, policy-wise, I would say very little. I mean, the good news is there is a local food movement, and there is increases in farmers' markets and CSAs and all these sort of alternative food sources, which is a very positive development. Unfortunately, though, our federal government gives very little support for that type of production by way of policies like the Farm Bill, which, as Marion said, the Congress can't even get passed, let alone have anything in it that would actually help support locally grown or organic produce. So, you know, there's a movement. I would say it's just still very nascent and remains parallel to this much larger, you know, monster of conventional agriculture, which unfortunately is seeing a lot of small farmers go by the wayside because they simply can't compete with the consolidated production facilities, you know, which can sell to for a much lower price to the likes of Taco Bell, et cetera. So, you know, again, it's just this ongoing problem of the large scale outdoing the smaller scale because they can afford to do better.
And, you know, also kind of this ties in with this email from David. He says, Whole Foods house brand sun-dried tomatoes come from Turkey. He asks the question, Whole Foods couldn't find any tomatoes in California. So is there kind of an automatic push towards bringing, you know, this importing thing? You know, is it, does it look like it will end anytime soon, or is the climate not conducive for that, for any changes? Marion Nessel.
You have to deal with the human rights issues. If people in developing countries were paid a decent wage, the food that they produced would cost what it costs here, even though we're not paying a decent wage to a lot of people who are in the food business. But all of this is about economics. As long as these companies can buy garlic is my favorite example. Garlic used to be made in California, used to be grown in California, the garlic festival and all of those kinds of things, and now it all comes from China. If people want to have locally grown food, they have to support local farmers to the extent that they can. And the one thing that drives so much of the locally grown movement is that the food tastes better. But not everybody can afford food that tastes better. And so you're caught up in this cycle of the way our economic system works, and that's what this is all about.
And another factor I would say is the expectation that we have perpetuated by, you know, making people think that they can have access to all forms, particularly of fresh produce, all year round. You know, I mean, fortunate in California, I actually do have access to local produce all year round. It changes with the seasons. I go without certain things certain times of the year because I understand that, you know, asparagus doesn't actually grow all year round in California. You know, and I think it's just that kind of mindset that, people need to understand. I remember the first time I realized I couldn't get bananas at my local farmer's market. Oh, right, because they're not grown here. You know, so it's just having that kind of education even so people can understand, well, maybe we don't really need tomatoes from Mexico if we just wait for when tomatoes are in season, you know, in my backyard. Or have regional, I mean, those pushes for, you know, regionalized production because, you know, understandably we can't all expect produce so close by. But if we do it regionally, if we look at certain practices for canning. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to promote local production. But again, we have to have policies that support that in addition to the education so that consumers understand what to expect and what not to expect.
Right. But do you think that, you know, policy is important to discuss? Do you think there's a cultural issue to discuss as well in terms of, you know, I can't wait for tomato season. I want tomatoes now. You know, this, I want it now. I want it now. Is there a cultural issue of kind of people feeling, you know, we're in this nation of abundance and I should be able to have everything I want when I want it, how I want it?
Yes, that is a problem. I mean, and, you know, to some extent it's okay, but like as Marion's saying, as long as people understand there's a cost to be paid. So, I mean, the tomato example is a good one because there's been a movement for years with the Florida tomato workers to try and get them a living wage, and their campaigns have been aimed at the fast food places like Taco Bell that are obviously sourcing a lot of tomatoes. But, you know, we need to pay the cost for that kind of expectation, and it's much more than we're paying now. You know, and so that's what has to be built into the system as well.
All right, let's go to another caller. Let's go to David in.
Can I say something?
Oh, Marion, go ahead.
Yeah, it's not much more. It's only pennies more. Even that is not something that these large food companies are willing to do. They could pay a decent wage or a better wage to the people who are working for them, and it would raise the price by a very, very small margin. But even that is enough to cut into their profits, and they object to that.
Hmm. Yeah.
So it isn't only that we've come to expect foods out of season, and I have to say, I like having foods out of season. I'm willing to pay for it, and I'm in a position where I can pay for it. But what we have as a nation have come to expect is food out of season that we're not willing to pay for. Mm-hmm. We want it to be just as cheap as if it were seasonal.
So educating the consumer?
How about making sure that people have enough money to buy food?
Mm. Yes.
Mm. All right, let's go to David on the phones. Hi, David. Welcome to your call.
Yeah, to pick up on that closing line, you know, I've gotten into the economic position where I can't be as fudgy about using organic. But I'm noticing that... at California that didn't pass the organic law, the vendors that I had talked to, food vendors, they don't seem to be very involved in their business to know why there's good regulations that should exist. To the point where now that I've been dealing with commercial non-organic markets, small family markets, apparently, the agri-growers are telling them what they have to buy. For instance, we all know how lousy fruits have tasted. I try to always buy California. Found a brand. Talked to the guy. Said, "Why do these last the 3 weeks? Now you only get these sparse leases." Well, the agri-vendor broker tells me what I have to buy. He chooses my pricing so that he can be competitive. Which is a lot different than it used to be 15, 20 years ago, where the guy would go down, he would barter for the best tasting products at 2, 3, and 4 o'clock in the morning and then bring the stuff in. But, you know, you can get tomatoes without buying them fresh. You can buy organic California canned tomatoes without the plastic PTE lining in the can. And it's a peculiar thing. Again, people are, I bought quite a few of them. Consumers at one store said, "Oh, I didn't recognize the brand." So they bought a more recognized brand that if you tasted it, it was horrible. But people will rely on a brand instead of using the brain to shop.
Hmm.
And that brand has the PTE lining inside the can. Half the product was green. I don't know what it is.
Okay.
That's what it is.
Thank you, David.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your call. Let's talk about, the consumer labeling and, you know, how can consumers track if food is actually imported or domestic? Michelle, you say that sometimes even health-conscious eaters are not immune from foodborne illness outbreaks, and you cite the example of hepatitis A found in organic frozen berries. Though the source of the original infection isn't clear, you say it probably did not originate in the United States. And there's a lot to talk about here. You know, you said this outbreak raises lots of questions about our food system. And so if we can just talk about this case, like you can even be a health-conscious eater and still get burnt.
Oh, certainly. I mean, and I thought that was a really good example. So this was an outbreak of hepatitis A in organic frozen berry mix that was sold at Costco and some other large chains. But if you looked at the packaging, at least on the front, all you would see is a nice little picture of a farm, and the brand was Townsend Farms, which is based in Oregon, does grow berries in season, but of course berries don't grow year-round in Oregon. So the rest of the year, they were importing the mix of berries and other fruit in this particular product, and it turned out the fruit was sourced from 3 different countries. And if you turned it over, because fruit is one of the few products that actually requires what's called country of origin labeling, you would have seen that the product mix came from Chile, Argentina, and Turkey. And in this case, the investigators were eventually able to trace the outbreak to the pomegranate seeds that came from Turkey. Okay, but again, like most people aren't going to that bother to even turn the product over. They're just looking and they're seeing the warm and fuzzy image of the farm. And so, you know, this is what's going on now, which we've all been calling farm washing, this idea that, you know, the produce is coming locally. In this case, it's somewhat deceptive, right? And the fact that it's organic to boot, of course, is giving consumers that sort of assurance that this is a healthy product. So, you know, what I found out was that organic has, you know, similar to the problem we were talking about with overseas inspections, it's just a paper trail. So in other words, when produce is imported from other countries, it's true that other countries have to follow the USDA organic standards, but there's simply a paper trail to say that that's happened. So all kinds of issues were raised with this particular outbreak. And so someone who thinks, oh, great, I'm buying organic, you know, frozen berries, looks like it's local, not so much. And it turns out in this case, you know, a lot of people got sick.
So what's a consumer to do then? And what's the solution?
Well, I mean, you know, it's funny because in thinking about this country of origin labeling, right? So, again, some fruits, fresh produce, does have to have country of origin labeling, some nuts, but even then it is confusing. So I actually am embarrassed to say that I had some pine nuts in my refrigerator from Trader Joe's. And so I turned it over, and it says, product of Korea, Russia, and Vietnam.
So which parts come from Korea, which part from Vietnam, which one, you know?
Right, exactly. So, you know, the rules are pretty lax. And by the way, the country of origin rules only apply to unprocessed foods. I mean, it applies to a very narrow part of the food supply to begin with. So for the most part, you're not going to know if the foods you're eating, certainly if it comes in processed or if the meat is required to be labeled, but not if it's cooked. And by the way, the meat industry is now suing USDA over stronger country of origin labeling rules. So, you know, it's a hard question to answer. What can a consumer do? I mean, asking, you know, where you're shopping, I think retailers and restaurants should be able to answer the question where your food is coming from. But unfortunately, the law does not require them to do so in every case.
And you mentioned Trader Joe's. You know, many consumers go to places like Trader Joe's and Whole Foods trusting, you know, in that, you know, I am getting a better product. I am getting that that organic is really organic. And but, you know, there's this slideshow I saw on Huffington Post called the top consumer product mishaps of 2012, the top contamination products of 2012. And, you know, one of them was this thing that I always get from Trader Joe's, and it was this basmati with butter chicken at Trader Joe's, and it was on that list. And I just want to ask you, Marion, about this consumer confidence in certain chains and brands like Trader Joe's, like Whole Foods. You know, we go to these places thinking, oh, it's like I'm going to the farmer's market. I am being a good consumer.
Yeah, they've done a terrific job of making people think that, and their consumer base needs to hold them accountable for living up to the company's values. But if they're doing the same kinds of things that everybody else is doing, then it's the only difference is that the food is, in general, of better quality. At least, you know, I live in New York, where we're not, you people in California are so fortunate. You have no idea. But I think there's no question that the food in Whole Foods, and sometimes in Trader Joe's, not always, seems to be better quality than what you see at the local grocery stores. But it's still not in the same category as you can get at a farmer's market. But people who don't have any money complain that the foods at the farmer's market cost a lot, and that gets us back into federal policy again.
Let's go to another caller. Andy in Redwood City, thanks for holding, and welcome to your call.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
To your guests. Hey, I saw an article back on June 27th in the New York Times. FDA says importers must audit food safety. And it quoted Margaret Hamburg, head of the FDA, and Michael R. Taylor, who was one of her deputies, and his ex-Monsanto, quite a bit. And basically, the gist of the article is the FDA doesn't have enough resources. It wants the importers to self-regulate. They don't have the resources to go at the supply chain choke points, which is where different critics say it should be done. And only 1 to 2% of all imported food is actually checked by the FDA, and 15% of the food we eat is from overseas. I say this is what the corporations want. They want self-regulation, which never, never, never works. Don't eat food that is produced overseas. It's ridiculous. You can't trust it if only 1 or 2% is checked. Self-regulation? Forget it. Any comments from your group?
Okay, thank you, Andy. Marion, you want to take that one?
Yeah, it's not quite self-regulation. It's a little bit more complicated than that because there will be third-party certification. Third-party certification raises its own questions about conflict of interest, but there will be certifying agencies who will certify that the foods are being produced according to the rules that have been laid down in the new regulations that have come out. Whether you think third-party certification is acceptable or not is something that everybody can debate, but it's one step better than self-regulation. I totally agree about self-regulation. There's plenty of evidence that it doesn't work.
Let me give out that phone number again, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. If you'd like to make a comment or have a question about food, your food, where it comes from, do you buy imported food? Do you care if it's imported? Do you try to buy local? Have you had an experience with contaminated food, you or someone you know, and what's that been like? And has that really changed anything in the way that you buy your food, you consume your food? 866-798-8255 or shoot us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So how could the new stricter regulations through the Food Safety Modernization Act adversely impact maybe small farm economies, if at all?
Michelle? Certainly a lot of controversy about that at the time the law was being drafted and was working its way through Congress. And as a result of advocacy done by actually the Center for Food Safety and some others, a compromise was struck in order to have some carve-out exemptions for small producers. And, you know, it was controversial, not only because obviously small producers were worried about additional regulatory burden, but, you know, E. coli doesn't know the size of a farm. So, you know, from a scientific perspective, it's questionable whether to be exempting small farms. But, you know, in order to, you know, as we always do with laws and regulations, try to strike a balance between not wanting to burden small business, some carve-outs were made. And, you know, I think, you know, there's still going to be griping, and there is, by those who are going to get caught up in the regulations. But, you know, I just think that's the way of any law. You have to find some way to draw the line.
Will they have to comply with expensive safety precautions that maybe really don't even apply to them?
Well, like I said, the smallest farms will be exempt, or depending on, you know, how, based on how much they produce or how much money they take in. I mean, there are, and that will be part of the comment period as well for, you know, producers to chime in on how exactly those regulations will apply.
All right. And we're going to take another call. Let's go to Patricia in Santa Cruz. Welcome, Patricia.
Hi. Hi. I just was listening to the radio earlier, NPR, and it was the one-year anniversary of 33 people dying from infected cantaloupe from Colorado.
Right.
I'd just like to point out that it's not all imported food. It's also some local, you know, but that was something that aired about an hour ago.
Right.
You know?
Right. Okay.
And it was just one farm almost destroyed the cantaloupe industry in Colorado because everyone was afraid of cantaloupe. And that's all.
So what does that mean for you, Patricia, when you hear news like that? What does it mean for you?
It means that you really don't know what you're eating if you're not growing it yourself.
So that story didn't tell you to just, like, wash cantaloupe?
Well, actually, it did. It did. I was like, from now on, I'm going to wash cantaloupe.
Yeah, yeah, I heard that, and that's what I thought, too.
I lived in Egypt for a number of years, and we got local produce, and I wasn't overly zealous about washing things, but at that point, it was just like small farmers. And I guess, you know, I don't know. I guess I was lucky.
All right. Thanks, Patricia. Yeah, I go overseas, too. And I don't know, maybe here, we, you know, our stomach bugs are acclimated to things that we eat here. And when we go over there, we become acclimated to those bacteria. I don't know. But I'd like to kind of go forward a little bit. And, you know, these new proposed rules are, you know, they've been published in the Federal Register. There's a 120-day public comment period. Can you give me an example of one of the rules? What's one that we can kind of try to understand right now, Marion?
Oh, third-party certification.
What does that mean?
Is one of the rules. It means that there will be agencies that will develop and will be hired by the FDA to or by the producers to certify that they're following the rules.
Okay, can we get another one?
There's so many.
Well, we've been talking about the import rules, the separate. So those two are related, the import rules that we've been discussing, and then the third-party certification, and then there's one on fresh produce, and then there's one actually on bioterrorism. So they're each trying to get at separate high-risk aspects of the food supply.
Okay. And they're inviting public input on these proposals. The rules are filed in the FDA's official docket at regulations.gov. They can also be accessed at fda.gov. And we will have all these links on our website. Still to come is the Preventive Controls for Animal Food rule, which would implement preventive controls at animal food facilities that are similar to those proposed for human food. We only have like 40 seconds. Marion, one last thing people need to know about this.
Complicated thing. You take a risk every time you eat something, no matter what it is. Cooking solves a lot of problems.
Just cook it.
If you're really, really worried about it, cook your food. It kills all the...
Cook your food is what Marion says. Michelle, one last thing from you, please.
I say buy local whenever possible and definitely wash your produce, the stuff that you can't cook. And be really aware and, you know, fight for better government regulations.
All right. And we'll have all those links online. Thank you so much for being with us, Michelle Simon, Mary Nessel. And thanks to you for all your emails and phone calls. I'm Hanat Baba sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. What is the U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about how the uprisings in the Arab world reshaped U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. Secretary of State John Kerry has brokered another round of negotiations between the Israelis and Palestinians. Why now? What forces drive U.S. Middle East policy? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.